Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is author and social justice activist and scholar Monique W. Morris. Morris is the founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute in Berkeley, California. She is the author of many books, including Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, Too Beautiful for Words, which is a novel, and her most recent, and what we'll be focusing on today, is Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls. Monique W. Morris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Sing a Rhythm and Dance a Blues is such a great enlightening book for this culture right now. But tell us why you use the blues as a metaphor for this subject.
Well, I wanted to anchor the conversation about healing in the blues because often people think about the blues only as a form of entertainment. And it was important for me to elevate the ways in which the blues can also facilitate what I call an emergent healing condition that rests on the idea that when you tell the truth and when you explore those truths with integrity and authenticity, that it opens us to a new opportunity to engage in some transformation, personal transformation, community transformation, or institutional transformation. So for me, the telling of the blues was really a metaphor for the ways in which we can engage in a telling of our own personal narratives in a way that can guide us to a new possibility.
Yeah, and I think we certainly need one right now. Now, bad behavior is tackled in many different ways in schools, intimidation, isolation, even arrest. I worked in the schools for a time, and I know this to be the truth. How can we be more instructive in quick terms?
Yeah, I think, you know, the way that we've approached disruptive behavior in schools is really guided by this idea that the harder or more harshly you punish someone, the more corrective the behavior will become. Mm-hmm. And I just think that on its premise, that is false and misguided. So what I propose, and really what Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is an invitation for those of us who work in schools, who are engaged in schools, who put our children in schools, to consider that if schools could become locations where young people heal from the disruptions and root causes of student misbehavior, then we can engage in the practice of learning. So the call is that if we engage in practices, you know, that really uplift one's capacity for healing, then we can uplift their capacity for learning. That includes restorative approaches or restorative justice. It includes conversations about having mindfulness and meditation. It includes having more counselors in schools and removing law enforcement from schools. It includes taking a deep look at the curriculum so that the way that we've come to define safety can also include the intellectual and emotional safety of girls of color who are often not considered when we're building lesson plans and can be opportunities for us to explore the ways in which, especially those who are survivors of sexual violence or other traumas, are not triggered by materials in the classroom, but rather engaged in a thoughtful and constructive way. And it requires us to really think about how we foster relationships with schools and the way that we read the behavior of girls, particularly Black and brown girls who are disproportionately experiencing school discipline because there is this reading of their behaviors as loud and sassy and combative. Mm-hmm. Instead of worrying about how sassy someone is or thinking about, you know, ways to further label a student, to really think about how we can build relationships that lead us to a deeper understanding of what she might be going through and that lead us to a space where educators can then facilitate a climate in the schools with students so that there's this appreciation for authentic engagement and safety.
Yeah,
we know that educators who do that kind of work, who are leading with empathy, who are building relationships with students and co-constructing the climates in schools, are the schools that have fewer suspensions, expulsions, have low truancy rates, and are the schools where there is actually an increase in the respect for authority and academic outcomes.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I noticed, too, that you talk a lot about this, how girls in trouble are often pushed away. But what they really need is to be brought closer and to be talked to and you know, have conversation and dialogue. To tell us about that. Is that changing at all? I mean, pushing girls away who are in trouble seems like the worst thing that one can do in this culture right now.
Yeah. I said that in my TED Talk. I said that, you know, our tendency has been to take girls and push them away. But what we've learned over time is that when you push someone away, that allows the pain to fester. So the harm just gets worse.
Yeah.
And then they come back more deeply harmed and the relationship's more deeply severed than before. My invitation is for us to think about how we can bring them in closer rather than push them away when they're experiencing a moment of crisis. And you can only do that if you, number one, recognize that the moment of crisis is not because she just simply, quote unquote, has a bad attitude or is a, quote unquote, problem child, but is someone who is experiencing a disruption in her life that requires repair. And that with the right kind of relationships, we can be what Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris refers to as ACEs buffers. There's a lot of language now floating, in the educational domain, in the public health domain, around this concept of childhood trauma or ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And Dr. Burke-Harris, you know, has written her book about this and serves as California's first Surgeon General, really trying to amplify the importance of recognizing childhood trauma and not just recognizing the trauma to say, oh, you know, my students are experiencing extraordinary trauma, too bad for them, but recognizing the trauma so that we can become buffers and build out the resilience, in their lives or increase their capacity to be resilient against the trauma and to heal from whatever disruption is causing, you know, some of the negative student behavior that we have in the past 20 to 25 years been criminalizing as opposed to fully engaging and helping them heal from.
Yeah.
And what we know is hurt people, right?
Yes.
So it's important, given what we know, to do something different.
Yeah, and you know, one of the key things that I think probably needs to happen is to help build young girls' self-esteem, you know? Because girls are still treated so differently in this culture.
Yeah, the self-esteem is an important, issue, but it also is guided by some of the emergent research that we have on adultification. This work that's coming out of Georgetown's Center on Poverty and Inequality that looks at how particularly Black girls are treated as more adult-like than their white peers informs how we are understanding self-esteem, how we support and engage girls around their esteem, and how we recognize when there's been a disruption and exercise patience and or a different healing modality, you know, around how we respond to that as opposed to a punitive engagement. The study found that Black girls experience adultification when they're as young as 5 years old, and it peaks when they're between the ages of 10 and 14, which means that we're seeing Black girls and we are assuming that they should be in greater control of their behaviors because we see them as being in need of less nurturing, less protection, that we believe them to know more about adult subjects and to be more independent. And if we do that, you know, and we're approaching them this way, then we're less likely to say, oh, this is a young person who's made a mistake. What we say is this person is a terrible person.
Yeah. That's true. Yep. That adds to the problem, I would say. Now, this era of school shootings has very often militarized school campuses. So talk to us about that and how that's affecting the whole culture.
Yeah, you know, I think that the school shootings are a result of two things, the absence of gun control, which this nation absolutely needs to focus on, and the disruptions that happen in schools that lead young people to feel that they do not have a relationship that allows them to feel worthy and engaged as whole people in these spaces. Again, hurt people.
Yes.
We're not typically talking about girls in that space. It's not typically a girl who is coming back into school to engage in that kind of behaviors. But we also know that when we forge the relationships with young people and engage counselors on campus, that we're able to identify those young people who may be experiencing disruptions or having other mental health conditions that may lead them to a more violent action if they don't otherwise have some formal intervention. We have to have better conversations about mental health in the society in general. But the militarization of schools, you know, certainly does have an impact on our girls. Some girls will interpret this militarization as, sort of a way of facilitating safety. But, you know, when you do a deeper dive with them around what they actually need to feel safe, it's not something that can be met with more guns. It's something that requires us to really think about how we're building out relationships between people, how we're building trust in the learning community, and how girls can sort of move through their learning environment without the threat of sexual violence or assault. That's often what we get when we talk to girls about this. And the increase in what I call the instruments of surveillance, or this increasing militarization in schools, really just brings in an external body to patrol and surveil, as opposed to really thinking about, you know, what our young people need to respond to their whole developing selves in this wild time of childhood and adolescence, right?
Yes.
When their
brains
are shifting, their bodies are changing, their relationships are tough, social media is tough. We've got to increase their capacity to be resilient in these spaces and, really increase their skill sets to manage some of these complex relationships, not simply to rely on law enforcement, who are not always equipped to deal with some of these things, come in and intervene.
Yeah.
And in some cases, they're the worst people to come in because they just have the tools that are the opposite of what our young people might need to actually facilitate wellness.
You talk about how schools really would be better off asking girls of color especially, what happened to you to create this hostile attitude and this bad behavior, instead of just doing punishment immediately? To talk to us about that.
Yeah.
And these girls need dialogue.
Yeah. You know, they need dialogue, and they also need to have spaces where, you know, we've cultivated this idea of practicing a trauma-informed, healing, you know, centered response to their activities and life experiences. When I talk about the question of what happened, that is really to align our schools with the practices in, you know, mental and behavioral health around being trauma-informed and responsive to healing. We don't ask, what did you do, right?
Yeah.
What I realized is, as I was mapping the push-out phenomenon and really sort of walking through communities and talking to educators as well as young girls and older girls about their experiences, often when there was a disruption in class, people would say, what did you do, right? Even the viral videos that show egregious behaviors or egregious responses to student behaviors that we recognize as violent, often the immediate question that follows that egregious behavior, if it's from law enforcement or an educator or something that has occurred in schools, is, what did she do?
Yes.
And that's the wrong question, right?
You're right.
I've challenged people to say, stop making that the first question, and the first question should actually be what happened,
mm-hmm.
which provides an opportunity for us to explore not just what she might have done as part of a coping mechanism to something else in her life, but to really fully engage in what the scenario was so that we can identify the point of disruption and make that the point then that we prioritize in the healing and repair of relationship.
Yeah.
It's a very different approach.
It is.
You also have to care. You have to care enough to ask those questions. And it centers, you know, this idea that there are all these different ways of engaging a particular incident, that when we identify what happened, then we're able to, you know, more deeply explore what's possible in the form of repair.
Yes, yes, instead of blame,
we can do that,
right?
With education as well as with, you know, sort of other disciplines.
Yeah, yeah. Now, girls of color are often not even portrayed in many teaching tools. So how does that affect identity and learning and behavior? Talk to us about the curriculums that probably need to be redone.
Well, one of the things that I say is that, you know, neglect and erasure are forms of violence.
Mm.
And we have to recognize the ways in which our educational systems and curricula prioritize in the canon and in this notion of what is classic, quote unquote, the language and material that does facilitate the erasure primarily of Black and brown voices, but really all people of color.
Yeah, yeah.
And women across the racial group, across the racial spectrum as well. So, there's this prioritization of a particular narrative that is deemed to be worthy of study that, does lead girls, especially girls of color, to believe that their narratives are not as valuable as other narratives, that their capacity as scholars is not likely to be developed as their counterparts, as their white counterparts. So there's been a long-standing critique of the curriculum and how we can diversify it and how we can think about the inclusion of more diverse voices. I stand with that and think that it's really important. But aside from that, with the girls, when I talk to them and when I, am talking to educators about how they work with them, it is important to recognize how the interventions that are emerging as the most effective to respond to some of the negative student behavior, particularly fighting and some of the aggressive language that's used in schools,
mm-hmm.
that some of the most promising strategies around curbing those kinds of behaviors really anchor themselves in curricula that are culturally responsive and that remind girls of who they are, remind girls of color of what their traditions have been, remind girls of color of the brilliance of Black and brown women who have emerged in spaces to, cultivate democracy, to engage in the practice of STEM and to really move conversations about, science so that they see themselves, they can locate themselves in the possibility of the society's advancement. When you don't see yourself, then you don't know what's possible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Monique W. Morris. We're talking about her book, Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls. It's a fascinating book. Did you want to continue on, Monique, about what you were saying?
Oh, no, it's okay. It's okay. The bottom line is you have to see yourself in the curriculum in order for you to feel present, to feel fully present.
Yes.
One of the things that I share in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is a statement from a young woman who leads work at Girls for Gender Equity in New York, and she said that, just being physically present in school is not enough. You have to see yourself as a part of the full body of learning and engagement, recognizing the multiple ways that we know things and the multiple ways that we learn things. It is really important to explore ways for our young people to not just go to school and see school as a place where you attend, but to see yourself as critically immersed in the learning experience in these institutions.
And having a say in how it,
exactly.
how it works. You know what? You talked also about how schools have dress codes, and oftentimes girls feel that they're being policed regarding their bodies and so on. So talk to us a little bit about that subject, because I found that fascinating.
Yeah, one of the things that talking about girls in the push-out experience allowed us to do was to explore all the ways that young people are experiencing this idea that they do not belong in schools, that have nothing to do with whether or not they're presenting a physical threat to the safety of a school. Many dress code policies are either overtly racist in how they describe what is appropriate hairstyle for school, where they'll say no afros, no braids or extensions, no dreadlocks, which, are disproportionately going to impact Black girls who culturally wear these hairstyles. And sort of norm the presentation of school to a European standard, which, is problematic on a host of levels.
Yeah.
The first of which I've already named is that it's racist. As we talk about, the school dress codes, there are certainly those that are overt in their language around those topics. But then there are the other ways that school dress codes facilitate a reading of Black girl bodies that leads them to feel that their actual physical being is being policed as opposed to examining enforcement of dress code. Now, yeah. I can go anywhere around the country and talk to girls of any racial and ethnic group, and they all come alive around the dress code because they feel in many ways, and I agree with them, in that these dress codes can be sexist and the implementation of them can be sexist.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that girls will be disproportionately sort of punished or reprimanded for wearing clothing that their male counterparts won't be.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
You know, you can't wear spaghetti straps or short shorts, but the boys, you know, can have baggy pants, or there's just more leeway with the boys. The issue is that, you know, when we look at these dress codes and we try to explore how to interrupt them, there are schools that have used language, and I share some of this language in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, that do facilitate the enforcement of dress codes. Well, first of all, the co-construction of a dress code so that young people are working with parents and those people are working with schools to design something that works for everyone, mm-hmm. but also that we enforce them in a way that is anti-oppressive and to really try to work on biases in the implementation or you know, adherence to, or discussions around the adherence to dress codes so that there is not this racial impact.
Yeah, yeah, and it's so obvious that there is a racial impact. Now, many of girls of color need to heal from just the perception that school is part of a cycle of harm. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, for many, you know, communities of color, just given the history of racial violence in the United States, you know, these institutions were part of what I call a tapestry of harm in their lives, where they had to reject their own cultural identities, their own language, their own sort of presentation. And this is related to the dress code, and it's related to engagements around the reading of Black girl bodies, but we see Black and brown girls who struggle sometimes to reconcile the historical narratives about what school has been for their parents or their grandparents with what it's supposed to be for them in their lives. We know that girls with an education are less likely to have contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system, less likely to live in poverty, less likely to be engaged in problematic relationships that can lead them to negative life outcomes. But for so many girls, particularly those that are most at risk of experiencing school pushout, school has not been the place that has fostered well-being in their parents' lives and in their grandparents' lives. So what I invite people to do in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is think about how schools can repair the relationship. We talk about restorative justice and restorative approaches between individuals, but one of the things that I've been calling for since the book Pushout was for us to think about how schools can repair their relationships with communities and how individuals and institutions can also repair harm. But you can't repair harm unless you first acknowledge that there was harm done in the first place.
Exactly.
We have to really think about how schools have functioned to reinforce the status quo of inequality, but how they don't have to be that, and how education for girls, you know, has been a radical transformative tool in communities of color. And so when we think about, you know, ways of repairing the relationship, it really is critical for us to explore how, you know, the violence that so many of our girls are experiencing with respect to school discipline then reinforces this notion of harm as opposed to you know, sort of countering that through a healing lens and really being part of what I call the tapestry of healing. So,
yeah.
So reconciling the history is important. It's important in the curriculum, but it's also important to the overall cultivation of a climate that invites girls to be who they are and engage in learning as the primary function of the school as opposed to discipline and social control.
Yeah. And that certainly is true. I've seen it everywhere. Now, one of the girls in your studies said, "We don't need police, we need a sense of community," which I found very moving, the idea of that. Kids are often looking for families in schools.
Well, they're looking for connection, like all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not that our kids need more discipline today than they did ever before. You know, I start the book by describing how discipline has been a part of the sort of narrative around young people for a very, very long time. But what we need is to remind ourselves that we grow, we learn, we thrive when we have positive relationships and when there is a sense of community. I thought she was very astute, which is why I included her quote in the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, our young people will tell you what they need if we ask them.
Yeah, yeah, I found that really moving too. Now, before we run out of time, I want you to talk about your organization, Emerge, in Oakland. Tell us a little bit about it. You're the head of it. You started it. What are you doing?
So I'm one of the co-founders of the Emerge Reentry Program, but it's actually run by the Mentoring Center in Oakland in partnership with the National Black Women's Justice Institute, Alameda County's Office of Education, and Girls, Inc. Mm. So we work with girls who have had histories of contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system and who have experienced school pushout. And we tailor an educational experience for them so that they can graduate. What we wanted to engage in was the practice of responding to this idea that some of our girls were disposable. These were girls often who would be otherwise not performing well in our alternative educational spaces. And, you know, historically, these are the girls who have been left to, you know, not complete their high school education, which has, you know, important impacts on their, you know, sort of future life options. And so I don't believe that young people are disposable. I don't believe anyone is disposable. I think it's important to, you know, go in and try to build out something that we can do that works. And in the next couple of months, we'll be releasing a study or a report that summarizes a 3-year study that we did with the Emerge program to explore what we've learned from this process of working with those girls who are deemed the hardest to reach in spaces like this, and how we've come to understand the promise of creating learning spaces that are healing. I think in many ways, the Emerge program is what led me to explore and discover that when we prioritize healing in the learning space, even those girls who were the most disruptive can become classroom leaders and be engaged as scholars, which we always knew was possible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Monique Morris, we are almost out of time. Can you give some contact information or whatever information you want to give out so people can get in touch?
Sure. So Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls, and Push Out the Criminalization of Black and Brown Girls are the foundations for a new documentary film that we have out that is screening in communities across the country and will broadcast in March on PBS. The film information can be found at pushoutfilm.com. My information about the books can also be found on my website at moniquewmorris.me, and on social media, I'm Monique W. Morris in most places.
Well, Monique Morris, thank you so much for joining. Both these books were so great. And for my listeners, we did talk to Monique a couple years ago about her book, Push Out. Please read both books. Monique, thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you so much. Be well.
You too. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.